program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is Heather McHugh, and she'll say hello with an opening poem.
Greetings, Grace. Thank you very much. This is a song for the Pennsylvania hills. It's something of a mordant love poem. I used to write them for faces. Now I write them for places, it seems. Song for the Pennsylvania hills. It was not because the heavens didn't shine upon the match, nor for want of indication that he thought himself a catch. He was able, he was stable as a Harvard running back. Of the requisite credentials, there was surely not a lack. Lack a coulda, lack a shoulda, lack a spermicidal foam. No, it was just for Lackawanna that I didn't take him home.
That is Heather McHugh, and you're going to get to know her in the following hour. I met her 25 years ago, have been following her ever since, and it is her humor, her brilliance, her genius, which keeps me following her. Now, I'm going to give you some of her credits, and we'd be here up very late if I gave all of them, but I'm looking at some 11 books she's written. I see 6 are collections of poetry. She has some translations. She has a book of essays, which is absolutely incredible. I'm going to teach it this year. And many other things in the workings. I know the most recent poems is The Father of the Predicaments, 1999. However, Hinge and Sign is the one that has gotten great notice. This is Wesleyan University Press. And it is a book which has won not only the Boston Book Review's Bingham Poetry Prize and the Pollack Harvard Review Prize, but it was a finalist for the National Book Award and was named Notable Book of the Year by the New York Times. This is an extraordinary book, and I think it's really done very, very well. And it has that beautiful silver thing on the front, so everyone should go out and get it.
My lovely photograph.
And you do not even have a seal on the front of your book that says, I'll trade you. It says National Book Award.
That's okay. I prefer that it not. I took that cover photo, so I prefer. A gold seal might have looked better with it.
Oh, you took the photo on the cover.
Yes.
That's another reason to go out and get it, folks. Her name is Heather McHugh. I am Grace Cavalieri. We are at the Library of Congress. We wouldn't want to be anywhere else. This is the home of books and the house of memory. And it is very welcoming to poets. So therefore, we're going to go further and farther with Heather. And first, we're going to hear another poem.
I'll read another that's for my dad. That first one really, it was very kind of you to use the word genius after it, but I fear it's more an example of doggerel in his honor. My dad actually died 2 years ago yesterday on my birthday. And he liked his poems understandable, metrical, and if humanly possible, funny. So I'm starting off with a couple really in that spirit and in honor of his. This one is the second part of a poem called Songs for Scientists. He was a marine biologist, and this one refers to the ornithologue at Audubon, who was responsible apparently for translating the bird songs into English. You can look them up at the back of the bird book. Translated more or less into recognizable English phrases. And here's a little tribute to that peculiar soul. Ornithologue at Audubon. You set your snares for love songs by the bower side and brook, but seemed inclined to haul your own callings back to the bird book, where to this day any fool who reads can find the winged singing things distinguished chiefly by their expertise in English. Take the goldfinch. What peculiar flight of fancy made it say potato chips? Hadn't it a higher sort of calling to its name? Or were you, sir, by any chance annuitized by lays? You claim a dove inquires, who cooks for you? It seems the birds are food-obsessed. Another specimen is heard to squawk out, quick, 3 beers, and soon the vireo appears impatient too, snapping, quick, quick, give me the rain check. The woods are thick with poet types and Pollyannas, pleased to meet you greeters, Segway artists gone from food to mood with a chip, chip, chipper, or a sweet, sweet, sweet. One bad Wordsworth versifies about, not only in the trees, trees, murmuring trees. No worse are the masochists pessimist, tenors from hell, the plovers disheartening, quit, 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 where Inca doves intone no hope, and thugs hiss, whip Tom Kelly. What's left for a thrasher to do? He lets out one sharp smack. To a lover's mind, I guess, that's more or less a kiss. You loved as much as punished them. You did not miss the courting eider's human-sounding moan, nor among warblers the black-throated blue zone. Please me, please, please squeeze me. Estimable sir, were you delirious or lonely? Maybe married. Were you unacquainted with the word displacement? Translators are ever undersung. But mark my words, some serious misanthropomorphizing got done to the hapless chachalaca. Best of birds, the one whose amorous aptitudes fell into permanent doubt when its females were quoted to cry, keep it up, and its males to reply, cut it out.
Heather McHugh, we're at the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. I've never read a poem exactly like that you've written. You will do anything for a thrill. And however, that is such a Heather poem. I probably could see that and know who wrote it because of the intricacies of the breaking apart of words, of the stacking, of the way you get into the words and use them and look at them at the same time and love them. Play with them. Mm-hmm. It's a very Heather poem.
It's a disease called linguophilia or logophilia.
And is there anyone practicing it so arduously as you are?
It feels like a romp in my playground more than an arduousness, perhaps an ardor, yes.
You talk about your sister and you in one poem, breaking words down, not to the particles, but to the crumbs, and a bedtime game, perhaps, you know, where language was really always your stick and your stone to build your little houses with. And it continues today. And I was trying to find another poet. Everyone will touch it a little bit. Every poet goes into this a little bit. But this is your soul, etymology.
That's
and
right.
Yet you use other languages and the sources of other languages. You must speak French.
At one time, I had quite a few languages. They've all languished as I've grown more debilitated and lost my brain cells. And if you don't use it, you lose it. But I did. I had a knack for languages as a kid. And the nuns had me for a while, and they Latinated me. And that's always a help. I regret, actually, not having had Greek, which would have fed another stream into
that. You mentioned that in
river.
Your book, in your essay. And Broken English is the book we're talking about now. And that is Wesleyan University Press as well. It's subtitled Poetry and Partiality. And each essay can be an exploration and can be seen as venturing into Zen, quantum physics, human spirit, etymology. It is a pretty far out book.
Well, thank you. I mean, I really appreciate that because I had people often ask me what kinds of things I read, what are the influences on me, and I've got to say that perhaps less than most people are those for most people are those influences principally literary. I read a great deal when I was a kid, but I read a lot. I read widely and continue to read widely. In fact, I generally rather read Nietzsche or Parmenides than I would contemporary poetry. I know this is unholy to say.
It's all there.
And, you know, I really love documentary film. I love electron microscopy. I love looking at those pictures of things, a familiar thing seen so deeply into its atomic structure that you don't recognize it anymore. I love that reminder that what we are is unknown to us. What's in language for me becomes a very material question. And you're absolutely right on the money when you identify that etymological leaning as an expression of that kind of interest. What's in a word? Gertrude Stein's very much interested in questions of content, and I am in a very material way too, because, you know, I can't see language as the conventional container that you pour full of meaning. It is already full of radiating atmospheres and energies, and all of those are the meanings.
You know, you keep breaking apart the armature to find out what's inside of it. And as you do this, you go into territory which has not been gone into before with language. Let's have another poem.
Let me read you the etymological dirge poem from the end of The Father of the Predicaments, then. It takes its epigraph from the lesser-known verse of the very well-known hymn, Amazing Grace, a song I dearly love, a hymn I dearly love. But I particularly love this line that most people don't love to read or think about, and that's the line, "'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear." Of course, that was before I knew I was to be interviewed by her in the studio. Etymological dirge. Calm comes from burning. Tall comes from fast. Comely doesn't come from come. Person comes from mask. The kin of charity is whore. The root of charity is dear. Incentive has its source in song and winning in the sufferer. Afford yourself what you can carry out. A coward and a coda share a word. We get our ugliness from fear. We get our danger from the Lord.
Is that from The Father of Predicaments?
Yes.
1999.
The last
poem. Wesleyan University. Yeah. If someone said to me, you have to sum Heather up in a phrase, that would not be hard for me. You know why? Because when I was reading Broken English, I saw the phrase, which absolutely signifies everything you stand for. And it was a remark you made, the vanished scene, the parentheses, vanished, parens, scene, S-E-E-N. And that is everything you deal with, what is seen and what is vanished from what is seen. And you talk about it in reference to time and space and Robert Capa, the photographer. Would you want to comment on that just a moment? Because it is so important to your philosophy, the future, the past, what exists.
Well, in fact, it's funny because I was just asked to give a kind of keynote talk at a romanticism conference. And God knows it took me a while to find a way to say what I felt about the romantics. It's not my favorite period in English poetry. But I must say that in the course of delving in Wordsworth, I again discovered what I always discover about in my experience of great art, and that is something about presence and its many senses, or the plural presence also and their many senses. Nailing, you assume that the three tenses are pretty much equiponderant, the past, the present, and the future, but in fact that's a construction of a sort of artificial construction of linguistic taxonomy. The truth is you either never can get the present. It's either this disappearing point between the past and the future, it's where they touch, or you never get out of it. You can never escape it. It's you're never in the past or the future. You're always in the present. And I love this quandary. I'm very interested in the spatialization of the present moment, in our inability to nail it, in our inability even to say what we are, although we can hyper-define features of being. I love that it's the kind of, that being is the kind of gerund, or perhaps a participial, depending how slipping you think it is, that can't be chastened into a deader kind of now.
That's why it's alive all the time, and it's nothing but energy in a way.
Yes.
And your work attacks this theory and presents it and unfolds it and shows it. And you even say in one essay, if the future is kept, it must be from the past. We can't keep something we haven't
ahead.
Had.
Well, you know that there are cultures, of course, in which the past is construed spatially to be ahead rather than behind,
you
because
say that.
You can see it, and the future to be behind us since we cannot see it. I love those surprising spatializations.
And you use them.
Yeah. I live very much as a sensual being, not so much a creature that makes sense in the intellectualizer's way. I'm much less interested in that, maybe just because of my own defects, constitutional defects. But I love the five senses, and maybe the sixth and seventh ones, too. The sixth, I'm pretty sure I have. The seventh, I'm working on. But all of them, one of the things I love about all of them is the sense I have that they go both ways. That is, everybody makes a big deal of the fabled feeling of poets. But from my point of view, it's not the feeling that nests inward that's so interesting. It's the expertise of feeling outward. It's the actually, you know how you can say, I look, I sound, I feel, I smell, God help my bedmate. And it goes two ways. You're either sniffing or you're being sniffed. I'm very interested in that sort of outward radiating skill at feeling.
What I love
gesture too.
Is that most people who are on the path of trying to live a life of understanding conscious thought as it is being formed don't use language to document mm-hmm. that trip.
That's right.
And that is the difference, that you actually use the paradigm of language to document that journey into the invisible.
Yeah, I appreciate that verb, document.
It truly is...
Well, it's a very sensitive field for the recording of all kinds of effects, even inadvertent recordings thereof, it seems to me. And actually, there's a little poem I'd love to read in that connection, if I may, because much of my work now, I feel that much of my work now has dispensed with the notion that I invent anything. I consider myself rather something of an editor of experience in the world, that I listen broadly, I scan for things and then select from among them and just place them side by side, and that the effects that one hears in the poems often arise just from that juxtaposition of things I've observed already existent in the world. This little poem, Acts of God, has two short parts, but both of them came from, as a matter of fact, public radio. I happened to hear on the airwaves, as one does while one's working around the house, a snippet of language. And by the time I registered what it was, I was enthralled, and I tried to record what I could of it. And you'll recognize that in each of these cases, someone has undergone and is testifying about a life-threatening moment. The first one's called Tornado. It was by a woman with a Hispanic accent. I didn't recognize what country she was from, but what was interesting to me was how hard it was to tell whether the quirks in her language came more from her newness to English or from the pressure of the memory of this devastating experience. Tornado. I said the people come inside. They would be safe in the building. So many of those people die. You can see my guilt. I could see hands to a lady moving. I knew the lady. You can see my guilt. Sometimes I want to run to get away from it. I ask forgiveness night and day. I ask it from the cemetery. I can never dream this storm away. It was over for maybe minutes. Then it was never over. 2, lightning. This was a guy struck by lightning. He was clearly an American, Midwestern accent. It pushed me backward. I could see my friends go backward too, as from a blast. But slowly, very slowly, everything was in a different time. It burned inside my body. I could feel my hands curl up. My pocket got on fire. I didn't want to reach in there and take a handful of the hot. My money hurt. I'm different now forever. Put that fact into your book. My hair used to be straight. My eyes, you see, they're gray as ash. They used to be light blue. You live, if you're lucky. But take my word. It changes how you look.
The voice of Heather McHugh. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. She's won many awards, and is she tired, right? her honors include 2 grants from NEA, a Guggenheim. She was elected chancellor of the Academy of American Poets. She teaches as a core faculty member in the MFA program for writers at Warren Wilson College and as Milman Writer in Residence at the University of Washington in Seattle. And she's been visiting professor at Iowa, at Berkeley, Alabama, and the University of Cincinnati. And I understand you are now going to be on the faculty at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm. Starting in January.
You're going to probably go back and forth
yes,
to Seattle. Everyone wants you
so.
Back again. So you transverse the world from airport to airport,
yes,
writing your
true.
Essays. And it's a hard life to be in
for
residence.
For a hermit.
This is true. Quite a challenge. Quite a challenge.
Yes.
When all you want to do is snuggle in your little cabin in Maine,
woods,
where we
yes.
won't tell the address.
Thank you.
Heather McHugh, she is. And she's been making history, but she didn't know it because she was so busy making it. And so
presence.
Right, the presence of it. One more poem.
Well, let me read a little poem that comes from having been a hermit kid in a certain way. That is, I was the kind of kid who never spoke in school or had many friends. I went to my room, and in there, I think part of my sense that poetry is a matter, and I mean the word matter, a matter of the uncontainable, comes from an early sense that you could go into a small place and find the uncontainable place inside it. So that the question of literary content became very dimensionally complex for me. And of course, that it's a reflection of a kind of emotional content. I went to my room and had I was one of the first kids on my block, though without friends I couldn't boast about it much, to have a really tiny transistor radio. And I used to lie, I remember, in bed and let the airwaves haul in, the frequencies haul in Detroit or haul in these far-off places from Virginia, where I was at the time. And wondrous musics and motions of the mind would come across the radio. And I early developed a love for many different kinds of music, rhythm and blues, country western, classics. The classical music was being played in my household all the time, but these were my other secret loves. And this is a poem called Sampling. It refers to that peculiar form of instrumentation in which someone retrieves a turntable from the trash bin and makes a good percussive instrument out of it. I've always loved that. I happen to be a big Mystical fan, Mystical with the K as well as the C. And this is a little song in homage to that resourceful percussive move, Sampling. When the table is turned, the hand resists. What should have been a drag becomes a drum, or potter's wheel, or rhythm section. Needle stick a stimulant and catch a can. The touch and timelines turn to an uncanny centrifuge of boosts and beats. The standard tunes are soon transmogrified to hiccup arts all down the street, with feline felonies of sly invention, licks of scratch. So somebody's unending love becomes at last merely amen, amensh, amention, all because bad vinyl snagged the handyman's attention.
I am happy to see some unpublished poems on your lap. This means something's happening on the airplane.
Well, when I'm grounded, when I'm lucky enough to be grounded.
So we have a book in progress.
Yeah, always.
Always, always, yes. It's an unending song.
Yes.
And another book of essays.
That's what I really yearn to work on now. I've been hauling around for about 6 years the mangled remains of various talks and lectures and teachings that I'd love to get into page-worthy shape. But one needs the clarity and space of a real stretch of time. And
will you be able to work on that from now until you go into January?
I have quite a few gigs on the road between now and then. It'll maybe be another year before that sees the publisher's desk. But
now let's talk about your marriage.
Okay.
A favorable one it is, too.
We'll compare notes.
Because
let's do girl talk.
It is. Your pillow talk has to do with translation. Mm-hmm. And this is a very venerable and well-known scholar that you're married
yes.
to, University of Washington, a professor of comparative literature. Mm-hmm. And I imagine a linguist.
Yes,
as well.
Russian. I mean, he grew up as, actually, he's Bulgarian, grew up under the tutelage of a wonderful translator mom. So he was really born and bred for the arts, that art.
And you together.
And was James Joyce's translator into Bulgarian, actually, of all peculiarities. As he points out, he hasn't been translated into English yet. So
which would be
it's
a prerequisite.
No audacity.
It would be a prerequisite for marrying you. I can just see that. Young, single, white female needs Russian translator of James Joyce. Who else would qualify?
A good Bulgarian.
Yes.
It's nice to have around.
And half of your married life, you say, you have worked together on your translations.
Oh, absolutely.
And
yes.
Most notably is the recent book, Paul Celan, Glottal Stop. And it is 101 poems of Celan, translated by Nikolai Popov.
Mm-hmm.
Did you say Popov?
Popov.
And yeah. Heather McHugh. Mm-hmm. Tell me about this journey. I know Celan is a very difficult poet to translate, and Robert Pinsky has given him some attention.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the most formidable book.
It is a very formidable enterprise because, I mean, and Celan has been well translated by others too. It's just that he's such a difficult writer, so hermetic, that one needs the ensemble of all possible translations, each of which, of course, is a literary interpretation of a difficult poet. One needs them all to begin to approach the total experience that Celan in the original would be for a remarkable reader.
Just
and
to begin
you
with.
You need to add all those minds together.
Who is he?
Paul Celan was a man who grew up in a part of Romania that was annexed both by the Germans and by the Russians during those difficult times of the century that just passed. He was made to work for a while in the camps. Both of his parents died in the camps. He escaped after having lugged a lot of rocks for years and having known that his mother died from a wound to the neck. He escaped to France, where in the early 70s he killed himself by drowning himself in the Seine. But none of this tells you what really matters, which is about the poetry. I mean, stories like that are something that people are attracted to. I think Sylvia Plath is still being underread for her poetry because she's being overread for her story, for the life story. I mean, it's still the peculiarities of that poetic gift, I think, get overshadowed a bit by the peculiarity and the sort of dramatic peculiarity of the life story. And the same thing in some ways is true of Celan. He's a very, very difficult poet. I don't think, had that life story not attended it, it would have gotten as much notice.
Yeah, but it shows up in his poetry. The glottal alone, the throat area,
yes.
Which is you use in every manner of means, also was the place where his mother was shot.
That's
there
right.
are many reverberances through this book of his life.
That's right. And the very sense that language matters that way again, that a hole in the head leaks blood or words, you know, and that you can hardly tell words from blood sometimes. There are moments in Celan where, you know, he speaks of the feelers of animals as though they were very near to lumps of language. And the materiality of language for him is very great. However peculiarly attenuated sometimes the poems look. But it was quite an enterprise quite an undertaking of many years to work even on these very spare poems, not least because I'm of a lyric temperament and my husband's of a more legalistic, scholarly temperament. He proceeds rationally, stone by stone, to make the perfect lapidary pathway with all of the illusions intact, building his road to the proper end, whereas I get there also, but I've just fallen off a cliff to get to the same place. I have these elations, leapings, and fallings that get me to that are intuitive motions in
a way.
Sounds
as if we need both of you.
I think
but
probably we do.
Celan is like you. Mm-hmm. And there is no accident when we become a disciple to someone. There is some like spirit, and your work is so much attempting to do what his work does, surely it is like finding a kindred spirit.
Well, yes, I was drawn to the work, I think, because of that materiality of its thinking. Mm. You know that it's a truism that poems are made not of ideas but of words, but I must say that there's a sense in which it is a very carnal thinking or a very thoughtful sensuality. That's what poetry feels like to me. When I'm working on a poem or when one begins to brew in me in a way, it feels like the cropping up of an idea, but it's a carnal idea. It's an idea I feel first with my five senses.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is Heather McHugh.
The size of Spokane. I should mention that having married a scholar, a skeptic scholar, was probably quite salutary for my... I mean, the marriage between a sap and a skeptic is always good for the world, it seems to me. It puts some brakes on both the skepticism and the sappiness. And someone once said that poetry was the intersection of an anxiety and a technique. And there's a sense in which we represent those two poles. We bring them to the translatorial enterprise, too. And in this poem, I think of my husband's influence. It was written shortly after we were married. And he's of Queen Victoria's opinion that, and I think I'm quoting accurately from Queen Victoria, that a baby is a very nasty object, and the prettiest is frightful when undressed. This sort of thinking will certainly dry up the sap in a marriage pretty damn fast, and you'll see maybe a bit of the vinegary side of things at the beginning of this poem. The size of Spokane. The baby isn't cute. In fact, he's a homely little pale and headlong stumbler. Still, he's one of us, the human beings stuck on Flight 295, Chicago to Spokane. And when he passes my seat twice at full tilt, this, then, that direction, I look down from Lethal Weapon 3 to see just why. He's running back and forth across a sun-blazed circle on the carpet. Something brilliant fallen from a porthole. So it's light amazing him. It's only light, despite some 300 people propped in rows for him to wonder at. It's light he can't get over, light he can't investigate enough, however many zones he runs across it, flickering himself. The umpteenth time I see him coming, I've had just about enough, but then he notices me noticing, and stops, one fat hand on my armrest, to inspect the oddities of me. Some people cannot hear. Some people cannot walk. But everyone was sunstruck once and set adrift. Have we forgotten how astonishing this is? Have we so practiced all our senses we cannot imagine them? Have we foreseen instead of seeing all the all there is? Each spectral port, each human eye is shot through with a hole, and everything we know goes in there where it feeds a blaze. In a flash, the baby's old. Mel Gibson's 100th comeback seems less clever. All his chases and embraces narrow down while we fly on in our plain radiance of vehicle toward what cannot stay small forever.
Well, you warmed up to him.
I warmed up. I can't help it. I'm a gusher.
I'd like another one.
Well, actually, maybe what I'll do is give you a few little excerpts. This may be of some interest, actually, to NPR-style audiences, since someone once lent me a copy of the PBS Underwriter Guidelines.
I know them well.
I found that document to be extremely interesting.
Well, why would you want to read it?
I couldn't stop reading it. The language was so peculiar. So let
it's
me just
legal.
Get remind you, there's a few excerpts that are just amazing. And you'll recognize, I mean, I've selected, of course, that's the editor's art. And as I say, I think all art is editorial. The world is made. Someone made it. It's already been done. It's just that we don't look at it. Yeah, right. Exactly. Cut and paste. Personal products, so to speak, we find are inappropriate. If you want time in our next day's edition, mind the waist to kneecap prohibition. Underwriting's advertising, but at PBS, the word's verboten. Product noises must be duly hidden. To be breathless, spokesmen are forbidden. Never claim you're dedicated here at PBS the way the rules stand now. Don't say you're prompt or quick or clear. A bright tomorrow, though, we do allow. Because they tend to trick the dim-witted, the use of humans has been strictly limited.
I kind of like it.
Well, almost everything in that poem is a quote. Almost everything. I've added a little glue here and there. Toxic glue, perhaps. But, I mean, actually, there is language in those guidelines.
The last line. Like, read the last line again.
Well, the use of humans strictly limited is a direct quote. Strictly limited. I mean, not to mention that announcers are forbidden to be breathless. I love it.
Doing a poetry program, we can just blot on.
Well, we're not underwriters. That's the difference. I mean, the thing is that it is a way of saying that you don't use advertising. That's behind it all is something that seems to me fairly significant in the way of sign making.
Nothing is safe from you, Heather. Is there no book?
I'm very grateful to PBS and NPR. Let me not
They've treated you well. They have treated you well, and you've treated. But I tell you, there is not a printed word that you are not going to pick up and dissect, turn it inside out.
It picks me up. Mm-hmm. I don't pick it up. I'm grabbed. I'm totally seized. I'm afraid it's a kind of
seized by language.
Defect. Yes.
Another poem.
Let's see. I'm going to shuffle here for a
moment. While she's searching, I'm going to talk about her a little bit more. She has gotten, I think, been treated well by the world of letters, and she's treated the world of letters well. And I don't think you've had too many unfavorable reviews. You probably don't read them. But I especially like Linda Gregerson.
She's a wonderful reader of poetry
and writer,
yes.
And in the New York Times Book Review, she takes on Hinge and Sign, which were poems from almost 30 years, 1968 to 1993. And among other things, she says, McHugh loves the thingness of words, their heft, their shimmy, their slickness, and burn. And she is a shameless fetishist. And she talks about her playful and unique relationship with words, resulting in distinct, original, compassionate, worldly, and spare work. She says that you are the laureate of physical love.
Ooh.
And many poets have tried before you. Her poems about sex are poems of poetic vocation. She turns that into language, too.
Yes.
You have a wonderful poem.
This actually would be a funny segue in a certain way. I'm reading a preponderance of poems here that people can't get in the books since they'll be able to go out and buy those. But I thought maybe in that connection, I could read a poem of the kind that she was referring, and then one newer one that's a little direr in the same vein.
Is it easy to find that poem where you and your husband have your wristwatches on?
Aha, yes.
That's a gorgeous poem. If you want to be the poet laureate of sex on this program, you have to put out.
Well, I was going to read Coming, but you want Going.
We have time for both. But that is just a beautifully made poem.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
It is almost physical.
Yes,
and as usual, it is almost not with you.
It's called Numberless. And Henry Fielding once referred to a creature that elements that composed, he said, that monstrous animal, a husband and wife. By law of rod and cone, The closer it gets, the darker it looks. We look benighted. I can hardly make out elbow, lobe, or nape. And once we go into the whole conundrum, it's by blind feel, slowly summing something's curve or multiplying verbs to come toward where our things have gone. The lampshade, doorknob, chair, they've gone inside. They've faded into eyelid, nipple, hip. It isn't long before the room and roof, the world at large, is gone inside us into humming, thumping, damp, and then there's only inside left to lose. And then it too is lost. All's lost in a drench, a din of downfall. Voltage pours away in brilliant, paralyzing pulse. Four walls and seven windows reappear. Our shoes show up right where we left them. Glasses poised beside the bed, the innocence that led us into such an indistinction. Now the eight-limbed animal begins to pull apart into the two of us. There's ticking. There's a cooling off. I see upon a pillow 7 inches from my face the watched wrists fallen side by side, and yours is a remming of fast-asleep silvers. The other must be mine. It's wide awake. It's strapped with hide.
I love that poem. That is a wonderful, wonderful poem.
Thank you.
It is complicated, but it is so true.
Well, there's this perspectival strangeness to intimacy with another human being. And it's a model for one's estrangement from oneself, which is the next level of intimacy, we presume, but shouldn't. That is, there are moments on a pillow or at very close quarters where you cannot see the end of the person. You know, you literally cannot see. You're so close that an eyebrow looks enormous. It's halfway to electron microscope work. And you can't see the end of them metaphorically in a certain way, too. That's what it is to be in love. You
That's right.
Sink into that.
But he's almost
closeness.
Escaped in that and free of it, and you are strapped.
That's true. That's true. Well, that's the old husband-wife thing. The guy turns over in the snoring. You know, the sawing wood begins, and the wife is there.
Do you like that
thrumming
poem?
Thrumming away. I bear a strange relationship to all my poems. I have a love-hate relationship with all my poems. It's like asking, do I like love? You know, half I'm assailed by it, and half I'm attached to it.
Some poems we think are more successful than others, and so we tend to treat them like favorite children, though.
That's interesting. I don't. I'm not out of any sense of prior principle or anything, the way, you know, mothers are very careful to love all their children alike. It's not that. I just don't. Once they're written, I don't recognize any of them anymore.
You didn't know you did it, probably.
Sometimes that's the case. I must say, when I wake up in the morning and I rush to the table to see what creature has written in the night, I must say it feels very strange sometimes. Actually, let me read this other recent poem, which is kind of a love poem, but I think suggests in some ways even the chillier side of one's explorations of the question of love and involvement with others and self-involvement. It's called The Looker, and it has that double looking working in it again, too. I was as dead as I could be, and you weren't there. They held a big glass up to me. They blocked the world with their life longing. What they wanted was a cloud, the kind that tells the living of themselves. But I was well past telling. I was a looker at last, head back, mouth wide as in a heat or holler. I had always looked my best like that in song or some astonishment. With a nose as close to her mouth as this, what aesthete would be caught dead with her mouth shut? It's a matter of the golden mean. And yet she knows, who cannot shut her mouth, she'd better be of finest words and few. A matter of the golden rule, a kind of courtesy. No faking, no mistaking. Only real love moans or wonders untranslatable. No sweat. When you're as dead as this, you're not a chatterbox or cheat. Don't fear to look. Don't look to stay. Given the almost clear, the near unclouded glass, in your absence, I took my breath away.
Oh, that is a love poem.
It is, for all of its austerities and cold views. It is a love poem. It's the truer love poem in a certain way.
The looking.
Than the sweet.
The looking from you. The first book, Danger, which you wrote in 77, I believe the first section is called Black Glass, and every poem deals with the eye or the perception or how one looks at the perception. Mm-hmm. And yeah. You use the eye actually in every poem almost. Mm-hmm. This is so much a part of almost a statement of what your life was going to be for you.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
it's laying out the road ahead. And looking comes up and comes up and comes up in you.
Here's one of the most recent ones, and there it is again.
There's
no
end to it. There is no end to what you're going to see with your mouth open.
It's the reflective mechanism, in a way, again, embodied in the eye. I mean, the weird thing about the eye is we think we see through it, but I'm not sure that it doesn't reflect constantly. You know, that is, send the rays back out without entirely absorbing them.
And you talk about mud behind the eye many times, and I think Ceylon also does.
Yeah, with him, there's a lot of mud in the mouth, too. I mean, that may be...
Aware of all the things you do? Do people tell you what you do? Do you have critics?
No, it's funny. Somebody once said to me quite early that they could tell one of my poems anywhere, that there was a style. And it's funny. Yes, you were saying that earlier. For me, that's quite strange to imagine. And again, I think this is another evidence of that peculiarity of being in a body or having a sense of seeing the world. You think each new poem, you think you're seeing another thing in the world. You think you've turned your head and are seeing something entirely different. But of course, for anybody else, the imprint of that eye, the human eye that does the seeing, is very much in the sight.
And it sounds like Heather McHugh saying.
Yes. Where to me, it's a new part of the world I'm addressing. The time when I have an opportunity actually to recognize that that's the case is when I look back at work from 5 or 10 years ago. And then I have that moment in which it's quite strange to me, and I can see its earmarks or eye marks, let's say. You know, there's that relation that one bears one's work. A year later, you sort of hate it and think you've moved beyond it. And then 5 years later, you start to be able to register it more coolly and actually assess it in some ways that you couldn't have otherwise. And 10 years later, you actually look back 10 or 15 years later and say, you feel a kind of parent's regard for the efforts of that younger writer. I mean, you can forgive it. You can see its promise. You can see how promising it is. I mean, I'm a teacher now for more than 25 years. And now I bear my early work a kind of indulgent parent or teacher's regard, not an overindulgence by any means. I can see its limitations, but I have a chance now to see a little more clearly at that distance.
Does your husband, who comes from a different but not all that different way of being educated, mm-hmm. does he truly dig your work? Does he?
That's
it to him before you finish it?
Well, yes and no are the two answers. Those are different questions. Respect he bears me, I'm very certain, and that is his literary respect. I'm also certain of his literary acumen, so I feel quite complimented by that. He's an honest man, a deeply, even painfully honest man. So that I can say that means I feel quite privileged. However, I don't show him the work before it's written, before it's finished, before I feel it's finished. Certainly not the poems. He's a real resource for me in the essays.
I saw that.
He covers my butt in some ways. He's the scholar. He makes sure I didn't manhandle the references and so on.
Having cut his teeth on James Joyce, he was ready for you.
Yes. Well, and this is the kind of man who, you know, tracks every allusion back, reads, if it refers to the German, reads the German philosophy in the original, and if that requires that he read the French.
And you do the sources of words French. In your essays. You do use the German source for words and the French word and the Latin. And as you say, if your Greek were better, you'd do that too. And that is all there.
That's an active presence for me too. I mean, there's a sense in which that's the latent, the past that becomes the presence of a language. Sometimes it's latent. And for many Americans who don't study many languages, it's a sort of unwitting presence, but it's operating within the language and energizing the language. And one doesn't have to know it to avail oneself of its energies, it seems to me.
You do that for us, though. We don't have to know it. We read Broken English, and then we know it. And that is Wesleyan University Press, as is Father of Predicaments, as is Ceylon. Mm-hmm. Paul Ceylon, the last three books.
Yeah, I've stuck with them. They keep things
They're
in
good
print.
They're good people.
And, yeah. And they have a long and distinguished history.
And they let
poetry.
You use your own covers.
Yes. When I get a decent
one.
Photograph, they let me use it.
Another poem. Oh, she is Heather McHugh. I should tell people who are just now turning off their car radio. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We are at the Library of Congress, and we are looking at all of her books spread out on the table.
Well, thank you. I might just read a little translation from the French of Rilke. It's more an interpretation, a kind of imitation, but it's not that far from the original after Rilke. Closed up like a mouth after a cry, the white house has its blinds all drawn. Out on the sundial, a peacock lies, causing midday hours to be gone. The roses will lose themselves tonight, too full of petaling in gentle agonies. My child, my friend, do not refuse the sight. For death gives life its clarities. One of the difficult things to do in translation is to preserve a metrical or rhyme structure that informs the poem. Very difficult to do, and many projects that my husband and I would have liked to have done, we didn't do because of
those
difficulties.
Some people don't do it.
Insurmountable.
Some people don't honor it.
Yeah. And sometimes I don't, where the poem in English seems to me achievable in some way. Some important thing about the poem seems achievable without that. But very often, in a case like that, one very much wants that consonance, resonance, I mean, that sense of consonance.
But we wanted to tell everyone who Rilke is. He's a specialty of yours, so tell the world.
Well, I greatly love Rilke. In some ways, you can say that he anticipates Ceylon, the great German poet of the generation just before Ceylon. The extraordinary thing about Paul Ceylon that I should have mentioned is that he grew up in a German-speaking part of Romania that was annexed by the Nazis and then the communists, and then went to France. And even though he was now in a French-speaking country, he continued to use German, which was his mother language. And the poems are written in German. And so the translations are from the German. So there's much made of this mother tongue, murderer tongue.
The language of the
peculiarity.
Nazis.
Yes.
Yeah.
But Rilke is the great precursor, a wondrous poet. I mean, the poet of celestial transport in many ways, but he achieves that celestial transport by laying eyes on the physical world for a long enough time, by studying the sensory evidence in the world. He apprenticed himself, or actually hired himself as a secretary to Rodin in order to study how painters see.
We are time now for a final poem. So is this your
timing.
Last poem?
Not the most recent one, but it is a poem called What He Thought, that pays some homage also to a European figure. You'll see, and again, it's a poem that was given me by the world, by which I was seized. I don't claim it. in any sense, except that I shut up enough to bespeak it now. What he thought. We were supposed to do a job in Italy and full of our feeling for ourselves. We were the poets from America. We went from Rome to Fano, met the mayor, mulled a couple matters over. What's cheap date, they asked us. What does this mean, flat drink? Among Italian literati, we could recognize our counterparts. The academic, the apologist, the arrogant, the amorous, the brazen, and the glib. And there was one administrator, the conservative, in suit of regulation gray, who, like a good tour guide, with measured pace and uninflected tone, narrated sights and histories the hired van hauled us past. Of all, he was most politic and least poetic, so it seemed. Our last few days in Rome, when all but three of the New World bards had flown, I found a book of poems this unprepossessing one had written. It was there in the Pensione room, a room he'd recommended, where it must have been abandoned by the German visitor. Was there a bus of them, to whom he had inscribed and dated it a month before? I couldn't read Italian, so I put the book back into the wardrobe's dark. We last Americans were due to leave tomorrow. For our parting evening, then, our host chose something in a family restaurant, and there we sat and chatted, sat and chewed, till, sensible, it was our last big chance to be poetic, make our mark. One of us asked, "What's poetry? Is it the fruits and vegetables and marketplace of Campo dei Fiori, or the statue there?" Because I was the glib one, I identified the answer instantly. I didn't have to think. The truth is both. It's both, I blurted out. But that was easy. That was easiest to say. What followed taught me something about difficulty. For our underestimated host spoke out, all of a sudden, with a rising passion, and he said, "The statue represents Giordano Bruno, brought to be burned in the public square because of his offense against authority, which was to say the church. His crime was his belief the universe does not revolve around the human being. God is no fixed point or central government, but rather is poured in waves through all things. All things move. If God is not the soul itself, he is the soul of the world." Such was his heresy. The day they brought him forth to die, they feared he might incite the crowd. The man was famous for his eloquence. And so his captors placed upon his face an iron mask in which he could not speak. That's how they burned him. That is how he died, without a word, in front of everyone. And poetry. We'd all put down our forks by now to listen to the man in gray. He went on softly, "Poetry is what he thought but did not say."
The voice of Heather McHugh. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. This program has been brought to you by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. We want to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Brad McCoy. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. I'm Grace Cavalieri. ¶¶